Hello, my name is Daniel Lev Shkolnik, and this is Reenchantment, a podcast about finding meaning in a secular age. Today, I had the pleasure of speaking with John Constable. John is part performer, playwright, poet, and a guide and guardian of the Crossbones Cemetery in London, where several hundred years ago, in the time of Shakespeare, prostitutes, beggars, and other outcasts were buried. John has given tours of the cemetery for about two decades, and through that time he's developed a very personal connection with the cemetery, saved it from being paved over by construction companies, and he's also written poems and plays about the cemetery after receiving a vision from a character called the Goose. And I think that John's story and his connection with the cemetery provides just a really beautiful example of what is possible when you have such a deep and intimate connection with a place and take real ownership of it. And also the ways in which when we engage with elements of our larger inner self, we can experience them in these archetypal forms that could provide guidance for us in our lives. With that said, I hope you enjoy diving into John's world as much as I do. Here's my conversation with John Constable. John Constable, welcome to Reenchantment.
Hello, Daniel. Good to
you and I. We met for the first time at the recent symposium about the kind of the creation of memento mori rituals to remember death. And my good friend Tony Wolf was the one organizing it. He gathered interesting collection of creators and ritualists. And I heard you talking about the work that you were doing at Crossbones Cemetery in London, and it was fascinating to me. It instantly sparked my curiosity, and so I figured, I want to learn more about what you do. And we might as well record the conversation because I think other people would probably also be interested. So why don't you say a few words about yourself, John, and the kind of work that you do at Crossbones?
Yeah, well, my name's John Constable. That's how I publish my work. I am a writer and performer, and have had a life, if not always earned a great living from this. And all my life, and particularly as I grew older, I think I became fascinated by the interface between art and what we'd call magic, and the way that magic and ritual in much more archaic societies operates, and the sense that we've lost that contact, a lot of ways of traditionally that we would establish contact with our ancestors and with the earth itself, with all beings, and with our place in things. And having worked in the theatre a lot, I saw that theatre and certain kinds of heightened performance can evoke something of this sense of transport, of somehow moving through personal grief and loss into a much larger experience, and that experience, which in the theatre is often called a catharsis, is something that art and theatre and poetry, in a sense, can come some way towards answering its absence in contemporary life, in Western contemporary life. My work, as I say, I've been working on this all my life, but it really came together when I got involved with Crossbones. I specifically with writing the Southwark Mysteries. This is, I guess, my life's work, really. It began in 1996, and I was living in one of the oldest parts of London, close to the River Thames and London Bridge. It's where Bankside was, where Shakespeare's theatre first blossomed. It was known as a liberty. It was outside the law of the City of London. And this attracted me for my millennial work. I wanted to write about my own neighborhood as this kind of outlaw neighborhood. And I was particularly attracted to fragments of history I discovered about the Winchester Geese, medieval sex workers who were licensed by the church to work in brothels that were actually often owned by the church, but were denied Christian burial. And that bit of the story, I hadn't fully taken on board. I didn't understand that they were denied Christian burial initially. What happened was I researched all this, and on the night of the 23rd November 1996, it was as if all the material I was assembling kind of interconnected and ignited and manifested as a spirit who called herself the Goose and told me her secret history, really, in verse, in songs and poems and incantations of various kinds. And I was writing them down, and as I wrote them down, it was as if I was being led on a journey with her. Or rather, I wasn't being led. I'd been working with a kind of shamanistic double, John Crowe, and who developed through my writing. And I always say this was the night he really took on a life of his own, along with the Goose. They both started to behave like autonomous entities, which was quite terrifying, to be honest, the night it happened. But out of that came this poem, which was unlike anything I'd ever written, because I hadn't really written in verse. And at the heart of the poem was a reference to the Crossbones graveyard, but well, we know how the carrion crow does feast in our Crossbones graveyard. And that led me on a trail of researching what I'd written and realizing that Crossbones was a place historically, it was a pauper's burial ground, but linked to it was this legend that this was the burial ground for the Winchester Geese. And really that connection, which seemed to have come from the space itself, because I'd actually been led there in the middle of the night. And at the time it was this desolate post-industrial work site that was awaiting redevelopment. And I'm going to let you draw other threads out, but really just to say this initiated for me, firstly, a literary work, The Southwark Mysteries, which was performed in Shakespeare's Globe and in Southwark Cathedral, but also gave rise to a much more street ritual performance, a body of street ritual performance work, at the center of which was the Halloween of Crossbones. And that was performed every Halloween for 13 successive years with the poems from the Southwark Mysteries, from the Goose and Crow spirits, the idea that they were working on Crossbones to reclaim it as sacred ground. And at the end of the performance, we had a procession to the site where we'd read the names of some of the people buried there and perform rituals to basically very inclusive, loosely pagan, but also including elements of Christian rituals to reclaim the site as sacred space. So that was our work, our spiritual work. And it was a kind of spiritual activism, because it was going side by side with initially fighting the developers and increasingly then, in a sense, trying to seduce them into a vision of what this place was, a unique sacred space. It's particularly, and as a result of all this, 25 years later, it is now open as a garden of remembrance, particularly dedicated to outcasts. And that grew out of the shrine that we originally made there as part of the Halloween by tying ribbons to the gates and mementos and tokens and totems. Gradually, we created this kind of living shrine, again, dedicated to the outcast dead. Over the 25 years of working at Crossbones, we realized we're doing it for the living. So it is really for the outcast, dead and alive. And that's a very short nutshell, and I'm happy to unpack that with you as you wish.
Wow, that's I'm so glad that I just let you go through that entire process. That's there's so
that's
much
the
there.
Very short version.
Right. I imagine. Okay, where to begin? Well, first of all, that's amazing. I think that's incredible, the way in which you, I think, like what is striking to me is the way in which you've found this place, found its history, found its dug deep into its past, and really established a sense of a relationship with this place, one that is personal to you, one that is has this spiritual component, christening it, creating a sacred space here where others only saw a work site, something for redevelopment. It reminds me of a conversation I recently had with someone that we were talking about entering into natural spaces and interacting with them with as a kind of sacred relationship. Sitting in a cave for day after day after day, returning to the same place, or returning to a piece of forest or a lake, and creating a relationship with that physical space, and in the process also coming to really care for it, learning the way that the seasons work there, the way that the animals work there, and coming to care for it. And it sounds like you've done gone through a very similar process with this burial ground.
In an urban environment. It's interesting.
In an urban environment.
Listening to you say that, because immediately I was thinking that for much of my life, when I thought of a sacred place, it would be a cave or a forest or a mountain. And I'd traveled all over the world to places like Bali and the Amazon, really looking for magic in a sense, or looking for the sacred still alive in the human consciousness. And it was very strange, the goose who, she did communicate with me very, very directly. Speaking, I was hearing voices and still do sometimes. And very much the signal she gave me before the whole vision really started unfolding was every place is sacred if you know where to look or how to look. And to me, that was really important. I'd lived in this part of London for 34 years, having lived all over the world and never anywhere for more than a year. I'd somehow felt at home here, but never really known why. And then the discovery of this place, or its discovery of me, because it really felt very integrated, not something that I was controlling like some Crowley-esque master magician. It was much more, for me, a sense of surrendering to what was happening around me and trying to stay out of the way and let it sort of speak itself through me, do its dance. I often think of it as the goose and John Crow doing their dance. So, and in that dance, it was like a secret history being revealed. And that, of course, inspired the work. And the work was very much to create this place, sacred place for outcasts, and particularly thinking of the sex workers, the Winchester geese, as being our emblematic patrons, or indeed the goose as being our protector in all our magical work there. And so all of this, for many years, I thought, well, this is something I'm doing because whatever, my weird psychology prepared me to self-identify as an outcast. I've happened to have had lots of friends who've been sex workers in my life who I've known as people, and so seen a whole other side of the kind of, so these things all prepared me for perhaps for the goose. But the strangest thing was only in the last few years I uncovered information about my grandmother, who my father and his family had all gone into care, and she'd been described as a thoroughly immoral woman. And my grandparents were married about 3 miles from Crossbones. And I hadn't fully taken this on board, well, certainly not in the time I was doing the work. So suddenly it was like a very literal ancestor I was honoring, but unconsciously. Whereas consciously I'd been honoring people who were not my flesh and blood or genetically related to me, but with whom I felt a kinship in some way, that these are outsiders, people with real lives, real stories to tell. And I'm not glamorizing at all the life of a medieval sex worker or of any of the contemporary real outcasts. I don't, I'm a self-identifying outcast. Many people who come to Crossbones are people who live on the street or who live incredibly vulnerable and tentative lives, So none of it, this is to glamorize that, but at the heart of the work is this idea of valuing the outsider, valuing the edge and the cracks in these beautifully constructed civilizations, and seeing that that is where, you know, Leonard Cohen's light gets in, and where the grass grows through, and where the exciting ideas that ultimately can transform societies seem to come from, to me. And so as part of, although a huge part of Crossbones is about reclaiming this physical space and saving it from redevelopment and creating a garden of remembrance, the place of sanctuary in the very heart of the city, because we've got the Shard, you know, the great Shard looming right behind it. I mean, you see it looking through the gates. And in a strange way, that really makes, to me, very potent the sense of why this is such a magical place. It's a wild place right in the heart of the most developed part of London at the moment. So
yeah.
I'm free ranging on this between the physical and the, as we were saying at the start, the metaphysical, the what one might call the astral, because to me that is a huge part of the work. It's to validate every life in all its perfections.
And you know, the way that I, what I hear you saying is this, I see it as this important symbolic work that is deep, that it is associated with human worth, human value. It speaks to, I think, to a certain area of human emotion, of those who find themselves outcasts, vulnerable, or maybe to those who aren't socially outcasts, but have a part of themselves that feels and recognizes what that might be like.
Certainly the people attracted to Crossbones, and, you know, as I say, in a sense, each of us is a self-identifying outcast. But, you know, that does include people with quite serious mental health issues, or perhaps addiction issues. It includes people with, you know, perhaps gender issues. A lot of LGBT people are really drawn to Crossbones because it does represent a place that... where sexuality, actually, the individuality of sexuality is just accepted as a given. And of course, many people who felt exiled from the church by their gender or sexual orientation naturally feel places like this that are not actually places of a controlled spirituality where there's a hierarchy at all. Although I hosted the vigils and most of the works there for 23 years. I did complete that work, and others are doing that, each in their own ways. And I think one of the most powerful things, aside from the vigils we host, is where just people themselves come to the gates and the shrine and make their own connection with Crossbones. And again and again, my wife Katie and I, when we were curating the gate, we would constantly be meeting people who would come, always with extraordinary stories. This is the living. And it, again, it reminds us, every one of these people buried in Crossbones, we can call them just paupers, we can pity them, but actually that's not to, I don't think that's to honor them. I think to honor them is to also realize that amid the brutality that undoubtedly their lives included, that there was also laughter and humor. They were people like us, and people, especially up against it, are very creative often and very playful, you know, even in the face of death, disease, and all the other horrors of life in that society. I mean, Crossbones in its most historical period, you know, was a pauper's graveyard. The Winchester Geese story is part legend, it's part, you know what, I channeled and as a secret history. It's got its roots in historical truth, but we do know, it's well documented that for 200 years the graveyard was for the very poorest people in one of the most violent and disease-ridden slums in London, you know, so it has that history of brutality. To me, what's wonderful about it, and this is where I see the spirit of the goose as this transforming, healing energy, is it has become a place of extraordinary beauty. Mm. In a sense, the horror and the abuse and the brutality out of which it grows is an important part of that story, and it sets that beauty in a real context, you know.
Yeah.
And it's why we continue to resist any attempts to over-prettify it. You know, there's a real resistance to let it be turned into a kind of heritage theme park site. The agency for the site has to be with the people who feel the connection, perhaps people who don't feel any other connection.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think about what keeps a sacred space vital, or a certain culture vital. You know, I think of New Orleans, my own city, and I think of Burning Man. I think of, you know, the ways in which people, especially in New Orleans, I see this all the time, a kind of, you know, interplay and pull towards kind of commodification and creating a kind of theme park of the city. Yes. to make money, and at the same time, many, you know, an opposite pull or a kind of strange parallel line of the quote unquote authentic city and the,
yes,
authentic artists, which is, I'll admit, is a blurry line between the two, because oftentimes those very artists are the ones that sometimes work and make money in the kind of theme park of New Orleans so they can live and,
yeah,
do the more authentic work that it doesn't pay very much. But it's I guess, like, what I'm driving at is what you mentioned. It's such a big struggle, I think, especially in larger discussions now about, you know, gentrification and ways in which kind of culture erodes when you try and make it into something commercially viable,
yes,
and lose touch with the people that first created it or the original spirit of the place.
And this is something, obviously, I very much hope. I'm not going to try and control the future of Crossbones. You know, it was very important for me that I closed, because it was a magical work as much as anything, and it lasted 23 years. If I hadn't closed it, I'd have felt it would have just gone very strange. As it is, so I'm not there sort of hovering over Crossbones anymore to see. I'm trusting what will happen there. But I tried... a lot to say what I do think is what's authentic about Crossbones. I always stress the kind of DIY aspect of it, you know, the sort of punk element of Crossbones, that many of the artworks there were given by somebody, or somebody just made something and put it there. And there is a sense of that, as opposed to, I'm not saying commissioned art could never work in Crossbones. I think there were other things were commissioned there, and that some of them are very beautiful, but it's important to have that balance and this sense of, as I say, our shrine at the gates. Anyone can tie a ribbon or put a little totem, a photograph of a loved one, and that's really important. That it's not it's not curated in an overbearing conceptual way. It's allowed to grow and develop and change. And to me, this is very much the spirit of Crossbones. It has to be able to accommodate people of all faiths and none, for example, and that they have their own space within it to find it. So, yes, I do. I would resist which I think will inevitably happen incrementally, that it will become mainstreamed. And already the development next door is calling itself using the Liberty in its name. And those kind of things are perhaps inevitable. I did accept that there is this big development happening next door. I mean, originally that development would have spilt right onto Crossbones. So we restricted ourselves to fighting for the area that we knew we could sort of defend and defend from the perspective of it being sacred ground and being the, you know, the burial ground for an estimated 15,000 bodies and souls. Mm. That's in a strong position, because it's It was estimated at more than £25 million, its development value, which is a lot of money, you know.
And it's a persuaded
Transport for London, one of the biggest, corporations in London, to actually lease this part of the land as a community garden. So its future is safe at least for another 30 years, and one would hope for as long as London lasts. I don't know if London will last much longer than that.
That's in many ways it's a resounding success, that you were able to convince and to show people, as you were saying, a vision for this land that was different than the kind of commercial, and redevelopment that they were planning on.
One thing that really taught me was, because I'm somebody from the counterculture, and like many in the counterculture, you have that tendency to mistrust straight society. And what the whole Crossbones journey taught me were there were plenty of people inside corporations who were potentially allies, who are looking for meaning and magic and to be somehow transported and inspired in their own lives. And some of those would come to Crossbones, maybe even to a vigil, and get something. And the effects of that we would later see down the line in certain people who played key roles in moving things forward. There was a real magic to the whole way this happened against the odds. And I could talk to you for hours about just the random, acts of serendipity and synchronicity that allowed this to happen.
I think that's a whole other subject. Yeah, I think that's a very important point. I'm glad that you mentioned it in terms of the ways in which you can find people in corporations that you might be surprised of their willingness and eagerness to find meaning in strange places. I come back to something that Brené Brown writes about in her book on leadership. It's people are just people. And once we start to look at them as you're part of this class or you're part of that class or you're part of this corporate entity, that itself is a dehumanizing process.
Totally. And I think it's probably we would all recognize, or many of us would recognize, that as perhaps one of the greatest threats to humanity, along with climate change, is that we become dehumanized and desensitized to disconnected from any sense of communal, shared common ground. And this is where I really feel Crossbones is so important to that it is a place that actually says we are human, and some of us do some really shit things. And it's not to excuse all behaviors at all, but not to actually selects people and then proceed to monster them, other than demonize them. And we see that happening on all sides of the political divides and the culture war divides. There are assumptions: either you're with us or against us. And if you're against us, you're probably against us for the very worst possible motives we can conceive. And I really feel people like us need to be putting out actually a very strong antidote to that, which is actually that all human beings have the capacity, clearly, for good and evil acts, good and evil here considered in a very simple way, how they affect others. And really our role is to find enough common ground to give people to make people feel safe and secure enough to be generous themselves. That is a huge work, but in small ways, at places like Burning Man or in Carnival in New Orleans, down one street, maybe sometimes it's happening, and it happens at Crossbones like that. People are there. They know why they're there. Nobody's going to make money or get advantage over another from this gathering. We're all going to get the advantage of connecting. And that is what so much of our work is about. It's finding new connections that build a sense of community and a sense in which each of us is free to have our own spiritual connection. And, whether that involves belief in a God or not, I don't think is the issue at all here. The issue is simply that we should have the freedom to do that, and that we should all actively seek means to find a common ground so that we're not all there shouting my God, your God, at each other when we come together. I mean, that saying perhaps very specifically in relation to the so-called New Age, which at least here in Glastonbury, which is probably the center of the New Age in England, you know, that particularly the coronavirus has been hugely divisive in terms of significant groups of people who deny its existence absolutely.
Mm.
And rather than actually listening to each other and finding common ground, that becomes a very divisive thing within people who otherwise would probably have so much in common.
Right.
I find that sad to see that. So I think, you know, these antidotes and theatre and ritual and play and collective action in the name of something bigger than ourselves, whatever, even if we don't name it, that is what it's about for me at the moment.
Yeah. You know, there's something that you mentioned early on that I find very interesting. The way in which you first began this work, you were an artist, a playwright before embarking on this.
Yeah.
But it seems like this began with what some might call a mystical experience.
Yes.
This,
I would call it that.
Yeah. This connection with this spirit, this composite character, this entity, the goose, and then your own embodiment of John Crow, this other entity. It makes me, and you said specifically, like, this isn't something that you were directing. It was something that was coming maybe spontaneously out of all the studying, the work, the place itself. It makes me reflect on how important, real authenticity is in doing something of this nature. You know, it's, I feel like if you're trying to do it, then you're not really doing it.
I know exactly what you're saying. That's the thing I went through a lot. I mean, in seeking to be authentic to it. And in the early days when the Southwark Mysteries was due to go on at Shakespeare's Globe and Southwark Cathedral, there were all kinds of committees ready to advise me on what this should be to be a real success. And it wasn't a question of a sort of the art, I am the author, that kind of artistic arrogance, but it was a sense of, no, I'm going to protect this vision because I know what it is, or it knows what it is.
Mm.
Can't really be made to fit other things. I mean, there was a very funny, one civic group wanted to get behind it, but then they weren't sure about having the goose as the lead character in a community drama, whether a medieval sex worker is appropriate. And I had this a lot. I mean, I have even gone into schools to talk about this work. And as long as I found, as long as the teacher was, briefed in advance so they didn't get suddenly embarrassed or horrified, actually children didn't have any problem with this kind of the ideas expressed at Crossbones. And I found many children so touched by it. I used to do guided walks and I'd take them to a lot of the much more obvious, places like Southwark Cathedral or the Globe, Shakespeare's Globe. And they'd, be a little impressed, but it was Crossbones that actually you could see hearts just opening because kids can connect with that, with the idea of the unfairness of it, the idea of children, little children being buried there, the idea of families too poor. These are all things that connect kids in contemporary London to the history of that place. And to me, this is why I see the work as happening on many, many levels. And to me, that reflects what Crossbones is above all. It's a liminal space. And I believe they're everywhere, of course. I don't think it's utterly unique, although I think it is unique in its own way. But these liminal spaces that allow us in some way to experience something outside of our own time frame or our own paradigm, of our particular culture, and give us a just a sense of connection with the past, with the ancestors, with people like us who've lived before. And then when we come together with other people like us, the living, at ceremonies to honor these outcast dead, I find very powerfully people feel this sense of genuine communion, you know, at least with other living beings and often with the dead as well. And to me, that this is a healing and a transformative process, because it all obviously connects to how we deal with the reality that we're all going to die.
Yeah.
And many of us have lost friends. I lost a very dear friend only last week. And this is a reality that, especially as we get older, becomes more and more frequent. And so I need a spiritual work, however peculiar mine might be, that actually allows me to face death and without necessarily having a belief system about whether there's an afterlife or not. I certainly can behave as if the astral has a reality, and what we think and do, our acts and thoughts on this plane, do affect somehow, whether one calls that an astral plane or even a kind of collective consciousness that others can then tap into. That's how I see art and magic working, you know, as helping provide the forms by which again and again we can mend ourselves and heal ourselves, because there's no shortage of things happening to atomize us and break us at the moment. So this, yeah, to me, is why these rituals are absolutely central to my life.
Yeah, and what would you say is the difference between art and magic? My impression is that art has more artifice in it, but at the same time, you know, now I think about it, it's like, well, maybe yes, maybe no. There is, again, in this real emphasis on authenticity in good art. So I was just wondering what your thoughts on that are.
You ask big questions, Daniel.
It's the only ones I have.
yeah, I mean, I can say just personally, you know, I played with the idea of being John Crow shaman at Crossbones, and I say played with it. I found I had to walk the walk, really, because spirits did come and they needed dealing with it. And yet, all through the work, I found it very helpful to also remind people and remind myself that I was also John Crow's showman. And I was actually a performance artist. And you could interpret everything I did at Crossbones in terms of a very long 23-year performance art piece. Now, to me, I find that liberating. I mean, I think this is to do very particularly with a Western take on magic, and particularly a Western take on shamanism. I mean, you know, we borrowed the word from Siberia. We applied it to a whole bunch of different practices, say in the Amazon and places like this, and then re-import it. And it becomes very often, you know, and I've had my spells of thinking, you know, this is kind of a sexy male role to play, the shaman. And I think it's made me very wary of that thing. And because as Westerners, often with quite sophisticated worldviews, which include a lot of skepticism and empiricism, I think we are deceiving ourselves if we think we can authentically enact the sort of things that a curandero might do in parts of Latin America, for example. I think the cultural framework is so different. So I find it quite helpful to remind myself again and again of the art and theater aspect of what I do, and that there are elements of consciousness. But that said, I would say great theater, the theater that affected me when I was young, for example, which I would include Lindsay Kemp's Flowers or 1789 by the Théâtre du Soleil. These were kind of theatres that absolutely moved moved you in a quasi-religious way, that made you feel transported and ecstatic and fearful all at the same time. Now, to me, that's where art is fulfilling its role of stepping into this huge gap, this huge hole in us, I feel, left when we lost the knack of shared ritual and communal worship. And, you know, obviously it still does exist within church communities, but that for people who, for whatever reason, find it hard to enter into that particular organized religion, then I think there is a real hunger still to have a form of communion, a form in which I'm connected with you and we both feel we're connected with something that's bigger than both of us and that in some way sustains our entire universe, however we conceive that to be.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's no accident that the basis of Burning Man is art in the desert, basically.
Yes.
Which then becomes, you find in that spiritual experience in New Orleans as well. When I think about the city here, there's, you know, you have Carnival, which is this outgrowth of a, you know, Catholic tradition, but so many of the ways in which it's engaged in here is, you know, by artists creating art, creating, you know, these very elaborate costumes and parades and puppets. And it is, you know, first and foremost, it is a spectacle of art, but then also it in certain moments provides this spiritual space that,
yes,
grows out of it.
It's a play, and the thing that I would say unites that and the sort of work I'm trying to do is this element of play. And that I think we, in our last conversation, we were talking about this, that play doesn't have to be frivolous. It should be light, but it can also be very serious play. Mm-hmm. It is how we learn, and it's how we change ourselves in less painful ways than flagellating ourselves sometimes. Actually, playful behavior will show us the way out of ourselves, because a great deal of our suffering, it seems to me, as now I'm approaching my old age, a great deal of my suffering anyway was largely self-imposed. It was to do with my image of who I thought I should be or was, and how I failed it or how other people didn't appreciate it. And as all that starts to fall away, you come back to something. Maybe it is, you know, the good aspect of returning, of second childhoods. I mean, you know, not to become, you know, not to lose all your faculties, but actually to lose a lot of the accretions that stop us playing in that period where we think that being an adult is about, you know, buttoning up and being very serious. And I think that applies very much to, you know, spiritual work, because the importance of play in spiritual work and of not taking ourselves seriously in that sense of becoming holier than thou. You know, I do, sometimes I'll go to rituals and people are using voices that just don't correspond to me, to how we talk to each other. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
And I feel it's really important to ground all this, because ritual is very simple, really, isn't it? It's drawing attention. We draw lines around something and say, here is a particular space of some particular significance, and we put objects on it and we say certain things and prayers, and all of this acts to allow us to create, I think, a liminal space in which our higher spiritual agencies, whether they're in us or come from beyond us, I would say both, really, because I think ultimately consciousness is one at its deepest level. This is as close as I get to a belief system. I do think consciousness is an unfolding, unified field, and it could be called the mind of God. That's not a bad way of approaching it. But you know, we know how God can be a very problematic archetype, because so often God just divides us from experiencing it.
Sure. Yeah.
So isn't shamanism and magical practice and all forms of, especially forms of ecstatic spiritual practice, I think they are in some way about creating, about dissolving in some ways. McKenna used to talk about psychedelics dissolving boundaries and clearly dissolving the boundary between oneself and the other. Mm-hmm. Other including everything, but including all that we would identify as God or goddess or divine being. So to me, yes, the tricks and techniques and arts and crafts that help us to do this. I've often described Crossbones, the key to Crossbones is to open the pathways so that whatever, if you and I are on two quite different spiritual journeys, the pathways, may they be open for both of us, and may we both come back with a different part of the puzzle and then, be able to listen and actually learn from each other's bit of the puzzle. To me, this is the rebuilding of spiritual community, which I think is going to be a long, arduous work, given the challenges to humanity at the moment and the pressures on us to, as I say, to, be each for themselves in many ways. So, all these ideas of that cooperation maybe is an entire alternative paradigm to the survival of the fittest obsession, to actually challenge these ideas, because so often I think we find we come up with an idea, with a thesis, with a paradigm, and then we act it out. So, it's no surprise that the history of the last few hundred years has tended to act out the assumptions that were made, increasingly that whatever one calls God, but that the higher spiritual realm had no empirical value, and therefore the material realm was where it was all to be done. And yet... the consequences were we comprehensively fucked the material realm in about 300 years. So there's a lesson there, I think, about ecology and about spiritual ecology being absolutely intrinsic to physical ecology. In our last discussion, you remember the idea was raised that really the... this disconnection from the earth is itself, as part of a massive spiritual malaise. Mm-hmm. And that particularly the delusion really going around still even in the progressive parts of the human race is that we've got to save the planet. And I think it was Tori Nade said, no, yeah, the planet will save herself. I deeply, deeply concur with that. I think
she said, the planet will go on without us. It's us who are giving up the chance to be a part of it and live on it.
And to let our beauty and our creativity and our all the brilliant things that human beings are, and we are even in these dark days, we are so many brilliant things. There are so many people doing extraordinary things. I think we're all feeling that we are on this real tipping point where will we manifest what we already know, mm-hmm. probably enough to radically alter the destructiveness of our lifestyles and to recreate a whole different purpose to life, which actually isn't about the accumulation of wealth at all. It's about sharing and community and telling stories again. I think in some, McKenna may have been mad in many aspects, but the archaic revival has a great deal to be said for it, for where we again start to build our sense of connection with the land through the stories we tell ourselves, through the ways we share. And coming back again, I suppose, to influences on Crossbones, because clearly the shrine was influenced by many traditions like the Day of the Dead in Mexico and many cultures where the connection with the ancestors and the sacred is much stronger than it is in in London, in a city, and yet something very authentic about that place seemed to manifest there. And I think we do, when we're recreating and reimagining spiritual community, I think we're inevitably going to draw on many, many sources. And a lot of what we've done at Crossbones was quite influenced by, for the last 20 years or so, Katie and I have been performing rituals at festivals and with other, mixing with other people, doing things, you know, like small versions of Burning Man. And I love the thing of you go somewhere and you set up a little shrine and you say, this place is special for this night. And
and it
brings something to make that.
Yeah, and it's I think that what you said about the long hard road ahead of recreating spiritual tradition or creating a new forms of it that really speak to the kind of globalizing nature of human culture, where we can no longer pretend that we our kind of group of people has the right story and it's the a universal, you know, human story. It's like there we can now see, there are hundreds upon thousands of different ways of interpreting the mystery of our existence, and finding ways in which to make our existence meaningful in the modern world will have to take into account this diversity of perspectives. And it's going to be a long road that requires inspiration and creativity and I think experimentation, much like the kind of work you and and others have been doing at Crossbones. And I think regardless of whether one interprets the breakdown of boundaries that McKenna was talking about, if that's between the inner and the outer world, or between the inner and the inner world, the conscious and the subconscious, which is my own interpretation of it. It is this, as you said, a kind of it's important to return to what we used to do, how we used to interact with nature, with one another, with communities, not necessarily to imitate and recreate that, but to learn from it and implement it in a way that makes sense in the modern world.
Completely. I remember about more than 20 years ago, I remember a bunch of us had a little seminar about, and the theme was, how do we make Gaia sexy? You know, it was that idea of, and I mean, you know, in a sense, to some extent that has happened. I mean, people do feel that is, it's the, you know, it's where do we put our energy, Daniel, isn't it really? And if we really get to value the idea of a bit like potlatch or something, you know, we get to value the idea of, if I've got some money, I'm going to throw this party and I'm going to have a bunch of people and something's going to happen here. And that is actually going to be one of the important ways I value my life, rather than I've got this many houses, this many cars, and so on and so on. And because so much of that kind of accumulative capitalism, I mean, necessarily it can only be valued because you've got something others haven't got. And without wishing to impose a sort of Soviet model of communism, I think we do have to find a radical third way. I mean, you know, and many greater thinkers than I have already pointed us somewhere in that direction. But from my little world of the arts, that's the bit I want to encourage, is that we really get to value the idea of life sharing, you know, communion, ritual, play together. And that this becomes increasingly, because it's a very low consumerist thing as well, you know, in terms of the planet. If we don't need to spend so much on kit all the time, you know, because we are satisfied, with you and I sitting round a campfire. I'm getting romantic now, but it is the one-to-one experience, the experience of sitting with friends under the stars or in a place that you've decided is a place of special significance. Those are the moments I feel we can change our lives. And, you know, sometimes when I think of what survives a life, and I do think, you know, all those images of what will be cast into the fire, for me, I think a lot of them are the time I spent trying to decide which can of baked beans, you know, to buy in the supermarket. I can't see that that is going to have great value in eternity, but maybe a real connection, an act of kindness, or an insight into the nature of being. Those are the things that will live beyond us.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And next time I'm in London, I'm going to try and stop by at Crossbones.
Please do. And even if you've got a week to spare, come and see us in Glastonbury.
Will do.
That'd be great.
Thank you for listening to Reenchantment. If you like this episode, please share it online or with a friend. It really helps the show to grow. And if you want to hear the Memoria Symposium, where John and I met, it's a panel about the art of dying, rituals that have death at their center. You can find a link to it in the episode notes, or simply search Memoria Symposium on YouTube. And if you're interested in reading some of John's writing, you can go to his website, crossbones.org.uk, where you can find out more about his work, about Crossbones, about where you can buy and read Southwark Mysteries and other work by John Constable. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next time on Reenchantment.